The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
There are two sides to Buddhist practice. There is the side of cultivation and the side of insight. And cultivation is how we develop ourselves, develop our inner qualities, our strengths, different personal characteristics, states, attitudes. And then there's the insight, which is what we see, what we're able to directly realize and understand for ourselves, not because we hear teachings about it or we read about it, but because the strength of our own power of observation, we see the truths that liberate us, that free us. And these two sides, the side of cultivation and the side of insight, are best balanced with each other. Because if one is emphasized more than the other, we tend to become imbalanced in the practice. If the insight is emphasized more than the cultivation, then there's a variety of problems that can happen. One is that it can seem, sometimes it can be kind of dreary. Some of the insights are, in and of themselves, you know, are not obviously happy insights. It's been said, self-knowledge is seldom good news. And also, sometimes it leads itself to intellectual understanding of Buddhism, because Buddhist teachers like myself sometimes will teach the insights that are meant to be insights, not teachings. It's hard to be a teacher. So then people will internalize them as teachings, as opposed to wait until they stand out through the own power of observation. If the emphasis is on cultivation and not the insights, then it can be seeming like an endless process of self-improvement project. And there's no kind of real wisdom in that cultivation that comes. The insight brings wisdom. So one of the really central insight teachings in our tradition is called the three characteristics. And when I was first introduced to this practice in Thailand, I heard endless Dharma talks on the three characteristics. And mostly in my ears, they sounded amazingly redundant. Like this, different teachers were teaching the same thing over and over again. It's just like, because it was, you know, it was kind of like the dogma. It felt kind of like the dogma of the tradition. And with the idea you're supposed to, everything was supposed to be seen through the filter of these three, what's called the three characteristics. And it's meant to be the three characteristics of everything that we can experience. And so it's supposed to be universal characteristics that we all share. And in seeing deeply into these universal characteristics, something very dramatic can happen with us, a kind of a realization, understanding, deep wisdom can occur. And the three characteristics is the deep perception into impermanence, the impermanent nature of reality, of phenomena. No one steps into the same river twice. The deep insight or perception of suffering, the suffering nature of this world, or the unsatisfactory nature of all things, a particular way in which things are unsatisfactory. And a deep insight into the teachings on not-self, or the insight of not-self. The third one in particular perplexes a lot of people. Not-self, no-self, then what self practices? The second one, suffering, can just seem depressing. Everything has the nature of being suffering and unsatisfactory. What's left then? And it can be just kind of discouraging and can seem like the point of Buddhism is just to suffer better. And then the first one, that everything's impermanent, can leave us in a sea of change and instability where we can't find our bearings very well. So these three characteristics, however, are the insight side of the two sides, insight and cultivation. On the cultivation side, we're actually cultivating, some of the things we're cultivating are the opposite qualities from the three characteristics. And the opposite qualities work together with the insights. there support them and develop them. They actually lay the foundation for allowing us to have effective insight in this way. So on the cultivation side, rather than cultivating impermanence, we're cultivating stability. A certain kind of permanence or semi-permanence. Instead of cultivating suffering, we have insight into suffering, but we cultivate well-being. Instead of we have insight into the not-self nature of ourselves, our experience, but we are cultivating confidence, strength, integrity, maybe even power is a word. A variety of qualities of inner character, which in Western psychological terms, in some psychological circles, we'll call developing a strong sense of self. Buddhists prefer not to call it a strong sense of self because of there's little problems that can occur with that, because as soon as you use the word self, it becomes a magnet for a lot of culturally conditioned ideas of what it means to have a self. And you avoid those problems if you don't say a strong sense of self. You say things like you're cultivating qualities of confidence, strength, integrity, courage, a variety of things like that. So I like to think of these six qualities as working together. So stability works together as a partner with the insight into impermanence. Well-being works as a partner with the insight into unsatisfactoriness or suffering. And that personal strengths, and strong cultivated strengths, work as a partner together with a deep insight into a not-self. And then it becomes a little more understandable, a little bit, some of the insights and the value of them, because if you just hear the insights by themselves, it kind of leaves you like, well, gee, you know, there's nothing, you know, everything seems so unstable and difficult, and they are, I don't even know who I am anymore. It's confusing. So the cultivation of stability is important. And so there are other words that can be used for this. One of the nice words is constancy, where you develop a constancy, a continuity, kind of a commitment in a variety of ways. So, or steadiness. I like the word steadiness. Stability. So meditation practice and Buddhist practice in general is meant to cultivate stability. A stable mind, a stable heart, a stable body. If the mind is agitated and restless and spinning around, it's very hard to have an effective insight or deep understanding of what's going on. We need to have a stable mind, a settled mind, a mind that has some permanence to it, provisional permanence, so we can see deeply into the nature of impermanence. One of the kind of paradoxes or reversals is that the more agitated and spinning the mind is, the more it's going to be caught up in concepts and ideas, a future, past, self, other people, all kinds of things. And concepts have the nature of being permanent because they're abstract. They don't really exist, concepts. And so we get caught up in the idea that things are permanent. When the mind becomes more and more stable and stiller, and not operating so much through the filter of concepts, the mind sees that everything is in flux. So the more stable the mind, the more things seen as changing. The more changeable and in flux the mind is, the more it tends to see things through the filter of certain kind of diluted kind of stability. So meditation helps create stability. Calm, steadiness in the mind. So the mind is not spinning and agitated. And so the mind is not, impermanent with all its churning thoughts and going on. There's also the stability or the constancy of regularity. Regularity is really important. Regular practice is important. Having a thread of regular daily practice is invaluable for the cultivation and development of inner qualities. If you want to develop physical strength, and you exercise once every third month, you know, those physical strengths are not going to be developed. You have to have regularity and constancy with the exercise to develop the physical strength. Same thing with the mental qualities. There has to be constancy and follow through with this. So in some Buddhist traditions, they talk a lot about the value of vow, of real commitment. The commitment provides stability or constancy or follow through or steadiness in the resolve. So this is a kind of a permanent quality, semi-permanent quality, a commitment to just keep practicing. This is very important for our psychology. I think it's very hard for the human psychology, heart, mind, to function optimally in chaotic, unstable situations. We see that clearly with children, that children who grow up in wildly unstable situation grow up kind of lost or chaotic or troubled, grow up with fear, grow up with the distress of a variety of kinds. And it's really important for children to have some stability. I've met many people who grew up in unstable situations. Some of the more dramatic ones are people who grew up in times of war. And I talk to people who grew up in times of war in different places in the world. And sometimes these situations were 50, 60, 70 years ago. And the effects of that instability that they grew up with is still with them because of how strong a conditioning it is. Societies themselves do much better if they're stable. Unstable societies, people tend to be agitated and people tend to be afraid and be much more in conflict with each other. And you see that around the world. We talk about unstable societies and the difficulties they have. Cultures which are stable, societies which are stable, allow education, allow development, allow economic growth, allow people to take care of each other, allow for so much more than when things are economically and socially unstable. So both societies and children, and I think it's also true for adults like all of you, that when your life is stable, you can tend to be able to respond most optimally. When things are quite unstable, it becomes stressful and difficult, and it's hard to pull forth sometimes the inner resources to deal with it. And an unstable life can happen very quickly, because of health concerns, accidents we're in, family, neighborhood problems that might occur. So how are we with instability? So to have some stability helps the heart, helps the mind, helps our psychology. And so cultivating stability is an important part of Buddhist practice. So I mentioned two already. I mentioned the calming, stabilizing effect of meditation, the constancy of regular practice. There's also the stability of having a good character. So being ethical and knowing that you're ethical and being able to kind of rely on that, settle something. They say, the cliche is that it's a good idea not to lie because then you have less to remember. Because once you start lying, you have to remember the lie and kind of, keep negotiating it and figuring out what to say. And so it makes things a little more unstable in the mind. You have to always be figuring. But if you're honest, there's a stability and resting in yourself and some certain kind of confidence that can arise because of that. When we started IMC, or when I started, see, this group was a sitting group before I joined, and I was invited to be the teacher in 1990. And we met in Palo Alto back then in a small group. And the way I was trained in Buddhism was was the idea that a teacher's constancy was very important for a group of people, a sangha, a community, to support their ongoing regular practice. And so I made it kind of a commitment to keep showing up. So I tried as much as I could. I made a real effort every Monday evening to show up because of this idea that the constancy of a teacher creates stability that allows a community to be supported and continue with their practice. I can't say that's actually the cause and effect relationship of what happened, but look what did happen. we've been fairly stable as a community now for I've been involved for 23 years, and we grow and developed, and after a while, it wasn't just me that provided the constancy, but there became kind of other people kept showing up on a regular basis, and that supported everyone, including me, in this growth and development. So having a constancy of a place of practice is very helpful for people of practice to keep showing up. I mean, imagine what would happen if, you know, instead of owning our building, we thought it'd be, you know, we're a renunciant tradition, we're supposed to be homeless, we're not supposed to have any possessions, you know, and just be relaxed and non-attached, and just kind of float around and not care. And so what we'll do is we'll just rent a different building every month. And, you know, 1 month we'll be in Redwood City, and the next month we'll be in Fremont, and then there's a good rent available up there in Richmond. So we'll sit up there for a month and, you know, kind of just go around. It might be very effective and very nice to bring these sitting groups to different communities. Maybe it's a nice thing to do. But for the community here on the peninsula, that's not going to create the stability and support the ongoing presence that's helpful. So these are all ways of emphasizing the value of stability and having it. It can be overdone. A person can get attached to stability and to permanence, and that's considered to be one of the great forms of suffering, is to be attached to things being permanent, the delusion of permanence. So we have to understand that we can't rely on things ultimately remaining stable and constant, but developing enough of it to support us while we can is very important. And then when it goes away, when we lose it, then we're prepared for it. And so then we can handle it better when that occurs. The second quality is that of well-being, kind of the opposite of the insight into suffering and unsatisfactoriness. And here, a lot of Buddhist practice emphasizes the cultivation of a variety of forms of well-being. I like the word well-being because it's significantly vague what it means, that you can fit a lot of different things under that. And there's a lot of words in Buddhism that qualifies forms of well-being. Buddhist texts talk about delight, they talk about contentment, they talk about joy, happiness, ecstasy, rapture, many things that, you know, fit in that sense of well-being. I also like the idea of well-being because it feels more modest than, more attainable than if I say, you know, ecstasy or something. Also, for me, the idea of well-being just feels nice in my body. When I hear the word well-being, I kind of soften and relax and open up. It just seems kind of accessible in a way that maybe being happy, you know, that word doesn't seem immediately accessible. So one of the fundamental practices cultivated in Buddhism is the practice of contentment. Not contentment that silly or naive contentment, just content with everything as it is. I'm suffering, therefore I'll be content with my suffering. But rather the contentment that supports the deepening of practice, supports stability. So, for example, we know that desires can be endless. And to always want more, to always think the grass is greener somewhere else, to always want what the Joneses want, to always kind of assume that all the advertisements are true and give good advice for living. And so the mind always wants stuff and wants stuff and wants more stuff. And what we have is not good enough. That kind of drivenness of the mind creates a lot of agitation and in some ways alienates ourselves from ourselves. It keeps us always running ahead and looking outside. Contentment, being content with what we have, is considered in a lot of spiritual circles a form of wealth. And some of the happiest people I know in my life have been some of the poorest people. Even here in the peninsula, relatively affluent area, I know people who are very poor. And one person I think of in particular is one of the happiest people I know. He's deeply content with his life as it is, and has a good life and doesn't have a lot of stuff, hardly anything, nothing of his own almost. And So the idea of cultivating contentment in a wise way, being content with what we have, being content with our physical goods we have, our situation. Perhaps sometimes it's appropriate to be content with work. Sometimes it's appropriate to be discontented with work and get the hell out of there. Sometimes I wish some people were being more discontented. There is wise discontent too. But there's wise contentment, and so contentment brings a certain joy, a sense of well-being. So to look, how can we cultivate wise content? And then there's developing a certain sense of happiness or joy or well-being because of the things that we do. Rather than expecting that happiness to just, be inherently there if we just, wishful thinking, that there's a certain kind of joy that comes from doing certain things. And so we have to engage in doing those things that cultivate and bring us that joy or happiness or well-being, even though it might be temporary. The Buddhist tradition emphasizes these things as bringing joy. And this was a foreign idea to me when I was young, and now I've come to appreciate it. So what I'm about to say is foreign to you. Think more deeply about it and explore it. So the joy of being ethical. The joy, I assume that most of you are pretty ethical people. But has it ever occurred to you to feel delight and happiness at that? To take time and kind of celebrate that you haven't killed or stolen or taken advantage of people recently? So the Buddhist tradition emphasizes that if you can live an ethical life, it's actually a healthy thing to feel good about yourself, have a certain kind of well-being from that ethical behavior. It's hard for some people to do that because even if they're being highly ethical, some people have this deeper underwriting operating system that they're inadequate or wrong already. So like for me, when I was in my early 20s, I wasn't guilty before proven so. I was guilty before I did anything. I didn't have to do anything to be guilty. I was just guilty. And so it took me a while to see how deep this operating system was for me, and to learn to let go of it and not have it trouble me. But the joy of being ethical. Another activity that the Buddhist tradition says brings joy or well-being, can, is generosity, to practice generosity. It doesn't have to mean you have to give money to anyone, but it could mean that you give your time and your labor. It could mean you give you sit down and listen to someone who needs to be listened to. It's a generous act. It could be that you go shopping for someone, or there's many, many ways of being generous. Opening a door for someone and letting them go before you is a generous thing to do. If you walk around your neighborhood and you see trash blowing around on the street, it's not your trash, you didn't put it there, it's someone else's problem, and you keep walking. That's okay, but if you pick up the trash as an act of generosity for your neighbors and for the beautification of your neighborhood and creating a little more sense of a stable community, that's a simple act of generosity. So to practice generosity as a way of availing yourself of joy and happiness. Some people find it hard to think of their good acts they've done, the good deeds they've done, and allow themselves to feel good about that or feel happy about that, because it seems like that's selfish. It seems like you're supposed to be just altruistic and not kind of benefit yourself from it. It seems like self-centered. It can be. So you have to watch out that you don't end up with too much conceit around these things. But you don't have to be conceited and attached to self and self-identity in order to spend some time just being delighted in an open-hearted, open-handed way for the goodness that you've done, your own goodness. So reflecting on your goodness and the good things you do. So even if you don't feel good, you can do good things. You don't have to wait to be good before you do good things. Be bad, but do good things. And then you'll see that that you start feeling good about yourself because of what you've done. It creates good memories, good connection with other people, and a variety of things. One of the functions of meditation practice itself is also to cultivate senses of well-being, feelings of well-being and joy. And so some of that just comes from developing the concentration. And as we get more settled and concentrated in meditation, a wellsprings of inner well-being, delight, joy, rapture have a chance to arise. If you've been meditating for a long time and you've never felt any kind of feeling of well-being as you meditate, even mild states of joy or delight or lightness, then probably it's a good idea to go talk to a teacher and explore what's going on and try to understand that and see other ways that you can touch into, tap into joy as you get as you meditate. The primary obstacle to feeling joy in meditation is thinking too much. And thinking about how you're going to be joyful just gets, it makes it even worse. So there has to be kind of a kind of letting go of thinking. Having desires, being caught up in the world of desires and aversions also makes it difficult. The deeper we can let go, it might seem that letting go is going to diminish you and you leave you with nothing. Deep letting go of meditation actually enhances you and opens up the wellsprings of our inner life that are often covered over when we're busy and lost in our thoughts and our desires and things. So we cultivate well-being. And just imagine, I'll give you a story from my practice life. A very important moment for me when I practiced in Burma, I was on a retreat in Burma, and I was doing walking meditation, and I had an insight that sometimes is kind of an insight apparently many people can have at a certain stage of practice, a comparable insight. So it wasn't unique, but came with a practice. But I was doing walking meditation, and my mind was relatively quiet, and I noticed that I was thinking about something that was a relatively innocent, lightweight kind of thought. I don't know what it was, but it's a very simple, ordinary, innocent kind of thinking. But my mind was still enough that I saw even that very simple, innocent, light thought had a quality of suffering or dukkha or tension or pressure or a tightness connected to it. Very mild. Irritation, something very, very mild. Something that normally I would never have noticed because you have to be very sensitive and quiet to notice it. And I saw, well, actually, this is a quality of all my thinking. Thinking always has this quality, this way. And then, in a flash, I felt, wow, this it must be true for everyone. And I thought, there is much more suffering in this world than I ever realized. It isn't just a big suffering, it's obvious, but there's this underlying layer of suffering. It's, wow, I was just like blown away, wow. So that was the insight into suffering. So you think, well, that's depressing. You know. However, that insight occurred at a time where I had a tremendous feeling of well-being, happiness, and joy as I was practicing there. I felt kind of radiating with well-being, with joy, as I was doing my walking meditation. And that juxtaposition of having all this joy and having this insight created a context for the insight, created a context where the insight was not depressing, but was actually inspiring to keep going with the practice and to go with the practice, not just for myself, but for other people as well. So the joy was very important for me for the holding the insight and suffering that I was having. It isn't one or the other. The two can work together. So then the last insight is that of not self. And the corollary for that in the cultivation world is to cultivate qualities of strength, confidence, courage. And we see this in a mythic way, perhaps, in the life story of the Buddha. You know, the Buddha was the one who taught this very deep insight into not-self. And he himself belonged to the warrior class of his time in India. And as is often the case, traditionally in warrior class, there's a tremendous sense of dignity and presence, even nobility sometimes in warriors. There's strength, there's courage there. The word that's used for energy, to have energy for practice, is virya. The Indian word, we use virya, comes from the word hero. And so you find some people want to translate it as heroic effort, rather than just, you know, you need to have more effort. You need to have heroic effort. Now that can be depressing also, like where am I going to find that? But this idea of Buddhist practice is not meant to make us kind of self-effacing blobs, kind of just kind of calm and relaxed and accepting, go along with everything, and it's all fine, man. But rather, there's a kind of cultivation of action, not just strength, but maybe a sense of personal power and efficacy, of stability, of dedication, of courage, of confidence that goes along with this. There are other personal qualities that can be cultivated as well, like the qualities of integrity, of honesty, of patience, of loving kindness, of equanimity. All these things can be cultivated so they become strengths. Concentration, faith, wisdom, discernment. All these are qualities that get cultivated and are meant to be cultivated so they become strong qualities that we carry with us and support us. And to some people will kind of somehow or other go fast in their practice and develop these deeper insights into impermanent suffering and not self, and find themselves that it throws them off, makes them unstable, makes them afraid, confused, disoriented. However, if the inner strengths are developed, then there's a strength to hold the insights and benefit from those insights. So someone, someone who feels kind of very powerful and confident and is told there is no self, they say, great, I'll just let go of myself, but they're still standing there with all the strength and confidence. It doesn't go away. They're there and present in a strong way. So the teaching of not self is not meant to diminish us, is not meant to make us kind of naively humble. The teaching of not self actually, in some ways, is supposed to help us become stronger people, more fearless, more able to stand up for ourselves and respond to the world. In the ancient texts, they even refer to people who have the deep insight into not self as great selves. The word is in the Pali text is maha atta. Atta, self, maha is great. And you bring those two words together and you get Mahatman in Indian language. So Mahatma Gandhi was the great self Gandhi. It's an ancient Indian title that even the ancient Buddhists used to describe they're the people who are most realized. That, you know, it's not just about disappearing as a self. So, the teaching of not self. Imagine now that you have a lot of confidence, a lot of personal strength, and your mind starts getting calmer and calmer. You're strong and calm and settled. And your mind is not thinking a lot anymore, not churning away, thinking about the future and the past, not trying to solve your life's problems. The mind is getting calm, quiet, settled. An image of a settled, quiet mind that some people like is that of a still alpine lake in early morning, very quiet and still. What works well about the wide alpine lake is how the mind gets very wide and still, expansive. Agitated mind is often contracted and full of churning waves. So imagine the mind gets quieter and quieter and quieter, fewer and fewer waves in the mind, stiller and stiller. And as the mind gets stiller and stiller, it's possible to watch and see how the mind thinks or has the impulse to feel that certain things are mine. But it's an impulse, a creation, an activity of the mind to say, this is mine. A And you can really see it. And you can, because you can see it arising, you can say, you know, this is an activity of the mind. I don't think I need this activity now. I don't need to be involved in this. Now I'm just creating more waves. Let me put it down. So, for example, many of you are sitting in chairs. Some of you are sitting on cushions that you borrowed from IMC. So it's possible that you were sitting here calmly, minding your own business in meditation. Maybe your mind got quiet and calm. And as you were sitting there, a thought arose, this is my chair. And nobody better have it, take it from me, because I claimed it for myself today. And you see this arising of this thought, my chair, and you see this is kind of ridiculous. My mind is really quiet and calm. Why sacrifice my calm for starting to think about my chair and protecting my chair? That's a thought that arises. In a kind of conventional, light way, while you're here, this in a sense is kind of your chair. If you go to the bathroom and you come back and someone's taken it, it feels a little bit odd, right? Because you kind of had it. But maybe you don't have to hold on to this, my chair. My chair is an activity of the mind. It's not inherent in the chair. We don't have your name inscribed on the chairs here. It's an activity of the mind. When the mind is busy and fast, it doesn't see it as an activity of the mind. It just sees it's the truth, it's the nature of things. We just operate it as if it's true. So if you're busy and agitated and need to go to the bathroom and you don't want to miss anything that I'm going to say and you're going to rush off and rush back and you want to sit close enough and you come back and someone's taken your chair, there's no presence of mind to notice how you're responding and reacting. You're just like punching the guy out. Because, you know, it's my chair. But it's an activity of the mind. So as the mind gets quieter and stronger, it's possible to notice the activities of the mind. A lot of what we do around self, taking things as mine, taking things as who I am, identifying with things, defining ourselves by certain things, are activities of the mind. And they're not necessarily inherent there, or if they are inherent in who you are, the identification, the involvement with that identity is an activity of the mind. So if it's an activity of the mind, is there a time and place where we put that down? We're willing to relax and let go. And at least in meditation is a time that's meant where the opportunity is there to put down every last vintage, is that right? Every last kind of trace. Vestige, thank you. Last the vestige of that activity of making me, myself, and mine. Identifying with, assuming I am. So here's a good question. When you don't have a thought, if you don't use your thinking to explain to yourself who are you? If you don't use concepts and thoughts and ideas to explain who are you? What are you left with? You're still here. Nothing's changed. You know, you haven't disappeared. Maybe you don't need as many concepts and ideas. So part of the Buddhist teachings on not self is to begin understanding how many of the activities of the mind, the constructs of the mind that we create around self, are really just constructs. And not always needed. Sometimes they're useful, and if they're useful, we can act on them. But sometimes they're not useful. They're not useful when they create suffering. And a lot of human suffering, a majority of it perhaps, is deeply connected to the constructs, the activities of the mind that center around me, myself, and mine. So the insight into not self is meant to be an insight that sees through this constructive activity of the mind, the activities of the mind around me, myself, and mine, and frees us from the grip of it. And then we're left, hopefully. If we've cultivated ourselves strongly, we are left with stability, well-being, and confidence. Isn't that great? Who needs self if you can have those three? So, now in the future, if you hear a talk on the three characteristics, suffering, impermanent suffering and not self, you might want to remember how important support and foundation for these insights are the opposites. That they're there in the background for that teaching. Stability, well-being, and confidence. Is that enough?